Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in the year 2000, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a poet and critic. His most successful book, The Savage God, was a study of suicide and included a description of his own failed attempt. At first, it seems a surprising subject for a man who, with his taste for rock climbing and poker, has otherwise displayed an energetic appetite for living. His first love, though, is literature. A brilliant student, a successful academic, and a highly influential poetry editor of The Observer, in the 50s and 60s, he helped to success some of the best-known writers of the post-war era, Ted Hughes, Sylvia Plath and Robert Lowell among them. Reflecting on all this, he says, "My first 30 years, when almost nothing went right, were purgatory. The last 40 have passed in no time at all." He is Al Alvarez. Does the suicide attempt then, Al, which seems to have been the watershed, if you like, between these two sections of your life, does it now seem like a ghastly aberration, or can you still touch into the desperation?
No, I find it very difficult to get to that. I don't think the depression went away. I think I was probably depressed for a long time, before and after. But it does seem as though it was done by somebody else. I think I said in The Savage God that, you know, it was as though, you know, I had died. For all I knew, I had died, and this was someone completely different.
And I think you also say that it's as if the boy Al swallowed the pills. It was the man Al who survived.
That's right, yeah. I think that happened to some extent.
So, I mean, perhaps, do you think looking death in the face made you grow up? Is that the implication of all of that?
Yeah, I think something had to make me grow up. It was taking an awful long time. I was 30, I had a child, I was already most of the way to a divorce. You'd think at that point you'd start growing up, not me. No, it took a much, much, much longer than that.
You were also at that time, and many would say have gone on being a brilliant critic. Tell me something. You've written that when you first began to be a critic, you know, you went to it because it was a kind of vocation. It sounds like a kind of missionary zeal that you had about it.
Well, you've got to remember, I'm an old man. I'm 70 years old. And I'm talking about late 40s and so on, when literary criticism was thought to be a kind of decent profession. It was something, you know, my son, the literary critic, was not quite as good as my son, the doctor, but maybe on a par with my son, the dentist, you know. It was not an altogether disreputable way of earning a living. Now, of course, it's a nightmare. There are hacks who just write whatever comes into their heads and are paid very little for it. And they are the standard reviewers, with one or two notable exceptions. And then there are the university people who are only interested in their own activity. They're not interested in the works of art. They're interested in the process of criticism, which is a specialised thing.
But that's the salt mine of intellectualism, according to you.
I think that is, yeah.
Out of touch with reality.
Yeah, huh? There is a great quote in Joyce Carey's Gully, Jimson, the Horse's Mouth, where he's talking about a piece of abstract art. And he says, it's all very clever, he said, but it's like farting Anning Laurie through a keyhole. It's very clever, but is it worth the effort?
Tell me about your first record.
My first record is the slow movement from Beethoven's 132, Opus 132 Quartet, which for me is the most beautiful piece of music that's ever been written. And Beethoven calls it a holy thanksgiving for recovery from a long illness. And it is about kind of rediscovering the world, I think. It has this extraordinary combination of earthiness and unearthliness. It seems to me the basis of all great art.
Thank you. the Hungarian quartet playing part of the slow movement of Beethoven's quartet Opus 132. So you've never been an establishment man, it has to be said, Al Alvarez. Didn't you begin your Oxford career by handing out broadsheets telling them how deplorable the lit crit there was?
Yeah, that was when I was an undergraduate. I was obviously a stroppy little swine. Not a nice young man, I'm sure.
What were you kicking against?
Well, English, you've got to remember that this, we're talking now about the end of the 40s, and English was not a subject that, you know, you did if you were smart. That English was a subject you read if you couldn't read classics or maths or the sciences. It was the humanities version of doing geography. No one was willing to talk kind of at all intelligently about literature. It was you responded to the magic of the thing, and if you didn't, you know, it was, and the word magic was a kind of favoured term at Oxford. They were slightly tougher minded at Cambridge, but Cambridge had other things going against it.
Well,
but
Cambridge had F.R. Leavis, of course.
F.R. Leavis, and they'd had I.A. Richards, who was the guy who'd started off the idea. You've actually got to look at poetry, you can, and if you look at it, you could actually discuss what's happening.
But they might have objected to being called the geography of the humanities, but nevertheless. You went to Cambridge at one point, didn't you, to talk about Hardy, about Jude the Obscure.
That's right.
Not a good reception.
Not a good reception. I was invited by something called the Doughty Society, which was the literary society of Downing College. And I knew, and Leavis had a code, or had a canon, and Thomas Hardy wasn't part of the canon, and you weren't supposed to read Thomas Hardy.
So he didn't come to your lecture?
He didn't come to my lecture, no. He gave me dinner and then told me that he was terribly sorry, he was busy. And I thought, well, at least one or two of them in the audience will have read the book, although it's on Leavis's index as a banned book. Nevertheless, you'd think that one or two of them might just have glanced at it.
But
wrong. No. And it turned into kind of total farce. I mean, you know, that you realise, there was that moment when I was sitting there and I realised, you know, what am I doing here? The lunatics really have taken over the asylum.
Tell me about your second record.
My second record is very different. My second record is Alfred Brendel playing the Schubert B flat sonata, one of his two last piano sonatas. Brendel is a neighbour of mine and a great personal friend. When he plays, you don't feel he's just a guy showing how well he can get through the notes. You feel that he's actually gone into the head of the composer and is thinking the piece out almost as though he were the composer, while he's playing. So there's a kind of wonderful intellectual tension as well as a great emotional tension running through each recording.
Alfred Brendel playing the opening of Schubert's piano sonata in B-flat, D960. You talk about Brendel getting inside the head of the composer. Is there something of that? Is that akin, then, to poetry criticism? Is that what you're saying, that you have to get inside?
I think so. You've got to be both kind of inside and outside. You have to try to be to see where he's going, which you do a lot of the time just by listening. It's I think it was Ian Richards once said that the rhythm is the one thing that you can't fake, and that when the poet is really upset, you can hear it. And he, by rhythm, he didn't mean, and the Assyrian came down like the wolf on the fold and his cohorts were gleaming and so forth. He didn't mean that. He meant that kind of subtle movement, you know. There's a great line in Merchant of Venice. Somebody says, "Peace, ho, the moon sleeps with Endymion and will not be awaked." All he really means is, "Oh, look, they're necking," you know. But it moves like water. Mm. Something really is happening. Something has to be happening inside the poet to get that rhythm. And you've got to be able to listen to that.
And when you write it yourself, which you have done, do you know when that happens? I mean, is there a complete right and wrong?
I think it's like one of those huge bank vaults, you know, where they have one of these very elaborate locks with 185 tumblers in it, you know. And until every tumbler is clicked into place, the door won't open, yeah? Mm. And I think that's exactly what happens with a poem. Until every word is right in place, the poem isn't finished, and you know it. Hmm. If you've got any kind of ear and any kind of critical intelligence, you know it's not right.
Next record. Tell me about that one.
The next record is... I went to a rather hearty public school called Arundel, where you had to be kind of good at games in order to survive, you know. And therefore, in order to survive, I became good at games. But the one cultural thing it had in those days was it had a very good music tradition, and they used to do Handel and Bach's B minor Mass and so on, with the whole school coming in. I think Handel is a great, great, great composer, you know, much better than even now he is reckoned to be. But what is extraordinary about this is that when he wrote it, he was 80-odd and blind. And speaking of someone who's 70-odd and not blind, this gives me hope that I may not yet be finished.
Michael Ginn singing "Or Let the Merry Bells" from Handel's L'Allegro, Il Penseroso ed Il Moderato, with the English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardner. You were born, Al Alvarez, with a kind of growth on your leg, which I think was another reason that you became kind of fearless Al at school, wasn't it? Somehow you had to take all the risks to prove you were...
I got a feeling that, yeah, I guess called compensation, isn't it? You know, it's the word you were so politely avoiding. yeah, probably. I think one of the reasons I came out fighting was that I had this great nanny. You've got to understand that I was 6 months old, and it was a kind of major, major, major operation. And so 6 months old, it's 1930, yeah? This is like 25 years before John Bowlby did all that research on the effect of having caregivers, as they're called, with children in hospital, how they you know, it helps them recover and so on and so forth. But for some reason or other, my nanny came with me into hospital, was there for weeks.
But there's a thread here too, I think, it seems to me, this what goes on to become a kind of recklessness at school and being a bit subversive at school, yeah. having a go, taking on the establishment. You can see, if you like, the kind of literary rebel in the making. And then by the time you get to Oxford, you're not frightened to take them on because this is sure. what you've grown up doing.
Well, I can't, I think that is true. And I don't think it was just being a sort of spoiled child, which I did. Wasn't necessarily that I kind of always been probably quite wrongly sure of my own convictions. I think that could just be another way of saying pig-headed or prejudice or blinkered or whatever. But I think one of the things I like are people who know what they know.
Who know what they know.
Somehow or other, I know this is no good. I really know this is good.
Mm. And being prepared to say you know something's good when everybody else is saying it's no good.
Yeah, well, I'd say this certainly happened, for instance, with Sylvia Plath's late poetry.
Indeed. Tell me about your next record before we talk more.
Yeah, well, a great deal of my life from the age of 20 to the age of 63... was spent in the climbing world, climbing rocks. And it was extremely anarchic. I mean, a lot of black humour. And one of the guys whom I climbed with a lot, a guy called Mo Antoine, who was a seriously funny, disruptive element in everybody's life, he introduced me to Dr. Hook and his medicine man.
Like the blow that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone.
Wanna see our pictures on the cover.
Stone.
Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother.
Yeah. Stone.
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Hey, I know how.
Rock and roll.
Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show singing cover of the Rolling Stone, and you say as a result they did get their picture on it.
Yeah, they actually did get their picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone. What I love about that sort of thing is the business of taking the mickey out of themselves.
Yes.
And that was what the climbing world was good about. You couldn't get away with pretension, unlike the literary world.
Another part of your recklessness, as well as this, the climbing, though, and the buzz, is poker playing, has been poker playing, or still is a bit, but, I mean...
A bit?
I see. Lot of it about.
I mean, no, I still play regularly, yes.
But we were talking at one point big-time gambling, hmm?
No. First of all, I don't gamble. I mean, see, I really... I have.
I thought you won an E-type Jaguar one
night. I was playing cards. I never bet on anything I can't shuffle.
I see. it's skill that wins this money.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the cards go round, obviously, and so sometimes they go for you and sometimes they go against. But the art is to lose as little when they're going as you can when they're going against and win as much as you can
Sounds
when they're going for.
Sounds pretty sensible. Tell me about being poetry editor of The Observer, which you were from the mid-50s, the mid-60s, moving from ridiculous to sublime.
All the way round.
In the main, it was the modern that you championed, as I said at the beginning, the what have been called the doomed confessional voices of Plath and Lowell and so on. What was so revolutionary about their work then? What was different? Why did the establishment have so much trouble letting it in?
Well, this was a period when the so-called movement was the style. Poems written in very... mostly written in plonking iambic pentameters, rhymed, and poems effectively like kind of good literary essays. You know, they had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they drew a moral, and so on and so forth. And it was all very nice, but it didn't seem to me what was relevant. I mean, say, I was myself very unhappy. I was going through a very bad period of my life, which culminated, as you said at the beginning, in a suicide attempt. It didn't seem to me that this was what...
It was all too genteel.
It was much too genteel. You know, we've just had 2 world wars, millions dead, Holocaust. You know, we got the bomb. Everyone, this was in the... You know, around 1960, you've got to remember that 1960, height of the Cold War, everybody thought we were going to be blown up. And I felt that these people, Lowell and then Sylvia, were very much writing about that strain.
I want to talk to you some more about Sylvia Plath, but let's pause for some music. What's it to be?
Yeah, well, this is to be music, I suppose, which is quite the reverse of all that strain. It's one of the great, beautiful pieces of music. It's the letter duet for Mozart's Marriage of Figaro.
Schwarzkopf and Irmgard Seyfried singing part of the letter duet from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan.
What I love about that, and which is one of the reasons also where I always prefer chamber music to orchestral music, is I love that feeling of conversation. Because it seems to me that's what all art is about. You know, you look at a painting on the wall and you suddenly you're having a kind of exchange with it. Mm. And it's very, very much what the business of writing is. You're always assuming there is some kind of ideal listener.
It's very much, of course, what I think you felt for Sylvia Plath and her work, wasn't it? Because she used to come to you and read it to you, her new stuff, didn't she?
Yeah, well, she came to me originally with her new stuff for two reasons. I think, and I don't think this is some piece of megalomania on my part, I think it seemed to her that I could hear in that conversational way that we're talking about, that she could hear what she was about, what she was trying to do. I was on the same wavelength. The other reason she came to me was that I was a friend of Ted's, and he'd come and stayed with me when he left the house, when he left her in the Devon house. And I think she kind of wanted to sniff around and see where he'd been, see if I knew where he was, which I didn't.
But she perhaps also wanted you to hear what she was really saying, which was the personal message, which was that she was, desolation.
Yeah, well, I failed her on that level, certainly. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult to do it. I mean, I tell you, it was difficult for two reasons. One, I was 30 years old and stupid. You know, what did I know about, chronic, clinical depression? You know, that's the... I'd been there. You know, I'd been clinically depressed, but I didn't know what it was when I was in it, as it were. And the more subtle reason is that the poems were so good and they were so full of life. I mean, there's more liveliness and energy and appetite in Sylvia Plath writing about death than there is in the collected works of Philip Larkin writing about what a bitch it is to be alive.
But when you went to see her, and it was the last time, as it turned out, that you saw her on Christmas Eve 1962, she read you Death and Co., The Dead Bell, The Dead Bell. Somebody's done for.
Well, at that point, I realised I knew where she was, yeah.
And she begged you to stay?
She wanted me to stay. I think, she wanted to help. I ducked out, it was, not a passage I'm particularly proud of, but my life was complicated. I had literally just sort of started getting involved with Anne, who became my second wife. And I could see that the kind of help Sylvia needed was not just someone to listen to her poems, although that was important, but she kind of needed someone to take care of her.
Hmm.
Yeah, and that wasn't something I could do. She was, at any rate, still at that point married to a friend of mine. I don't think it would have made a blind bit of difference. If she and I had got together, because I think she and Ted were absolutely eternally linked.
Do you?
Yoked together, yeah.
Record number six.
Record number six is... It's a little bit of past and present in that when I first went to America in 1953. I was at Princeton, and one afternoon I happened to go past this auditorium, and I heard this ethereal, incredible music coming out. And it was a group called Pro Musica Antiqua, conducted by a guy called Safford Cape, who were the only people who were really playing in those days. It was School of Notre Dame, and it was Leoninus, it was something about Leoninus. It was quite extraordinary, and I kind of went in and stood at the back while they rehearsed, and I got a terrific taste for this kind of music. But it was very difficult because no one was recording it. And now recently, it has been rediscovered. Many early music has been rediscovered.
The Hilliard Ensemble with Jan Gabarek performing Pace Mihi Domine from Cristobal de Morales' Officium. Again, all of that, Al, a lifetime ago now. Since all of that happened, you've written numerous novels, climbed numerous mountains, married happily, had three children. But now you're 70. Your climbing days are over because your right ankle's packed up, and you don't gamble, I understand, quite as big as you do.
I never gambled. I only play cards.
But what do you do for kicks now?
I play a little poker every week, and I go swimming in the very icy ponds on Hampstead Heath.
What, every morning?
No, about four or five times a week.
All year round?
All year round. This is a new thing. I discovered it last year in my 70th year, because what had happened was, I'd been swimming in one of the ponds called the Mixed Pond ever since I was 11. But they only open it on the 1st of May and they close it in mid-September. And because my ankle collapsed because of a climbing accident, the other ankle, I mean, it's what the critic Northrop Frye would call a fearful symmetry. I came in limping on one ankle and I'm going out limping on the other one. When they closed the Mixed Pond in September, mid-September, I thought, well, I'm enjoying this. I better go on and do it. So I then went on through the year.
Word enjoy. I mean, it sounds like sheer masochism.
You come out feeling absolutely wonderful.
Record number seven.
Well, record number seven is my dear friend Zero Mostel, who was really one of the funniest men ever. And he was one of these guys with a kind of permanently opened hotline to his infancy. Not to his childhood, but to his infancy. And this huge figure could become a sort of baby instantly. I was once in a pub with Zero and Joan Littlewood. And Zero got bored, so he shoved his fist into Joan's face and he said, "Come on, Joan, blow me up." So she took hold of his thumb and blew. And Zero, who'd been sitting, kind of collapsed and deflated, sort of gradually swelled up until he was apparently totally round and then floated, detached from gravity, round the bar. And then as he floated past me a second time round, I went like, I poked him with my cigarette and he went, and collapsed. He was a kind of genius. He could do anything. He could become a coffee percolator, become a balloon, become an aeroplane, you know, aeroplane lost in the fog. He was, became wallpaper. He was a most extraordinary man.
I knew the moment that I met her that it was forevermore. Now I look back and see why my life used to be so empty for me before. I was an incubator baby and she was the girl next door.
Zero Mostel and I Was an Incubator Baby from his album Songs My Mother Never Sang. So, Al Alvarez, on a desert island, you've proved you're a survivor. You don't fall apart in a crisis. Well, not these days anyway. What will you do with yourself all day on this island?
Well, it's a very interesting point. Probably, I don't know. I mean, it's complicated. In the old days, I would have done Robinson Crusoe and built myself a hut and done all that, because I kind of like doing things. I've always worked on the supposition that I'm only going to get one shot at this planet, so I want to not merely see what's on offer, but I kind of want to see what I can do, and I like fixing things. A friend of mine once said, I can't think of anything more terrifying than the sight of Al with a screwdriver in his hand. But actually, I'm quite good at stuff. I used to be able to fix cars and so on and so forth.
You might write a poem again.
Ah, wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be lovely?
Tell me about your last record.
Well, I want Ella and Louis, and I want They Can't Take That Away From Me, because it was a song that my wife and I used to dance to in our youth a great deal. And since we kept on breaking up all the time, before we actually... We had a lot of divorces before we finally got married. We'd saved having them after, you know. it's a kind of good solution. And it was a song that always seemed relevant. And also, the thing about Ella and Louis is that you can hear the buzz between them. You know, that she's got this voice like sort of shot silk or velvet or something, and he's got this wonderful, mellow, subtle, witty sound.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that, no.
They can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that away from me. Swing it, boys.
Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, and They Can't Take That Away From Me. If you could only take one of those with you, Al, which one would it be?
That's an unfair question. But I guess it would have to be the Beethoven. The Slow Movement of Opus 132.
And what about your book, as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
Yeah, well, I originally thought, well, what I can't kind of live without is the poems of John Donne. But actually, I've got one of those trick memories, and so I used to be able to read a poem two or three times and I know it by heart. So I tell you the book I want to take is Freud's Interpretation of Dreams. Now, the thing about interpretation of dreams is it's full of these kind of case histories, which are like little Russian novels in themselves, aren't they? But what is also wonderful is it's full of thinking. This is a guy who thinks about every bit of information that comes to him. It would be good to have such sort of passionate and stringent intellectual companionship.
And what about your luxury?
My luxury? Well, it would be the reverse of that. I think that I can pass an awful lot of addicted, obsessed, totally content hours with a laptop computer with a bit of poker software on it.
But no gambling.
No gambling, no, no.
Al Alvarez, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.